But in reality, all the project that they have conducted in Syria has failed. They wasn't successful in, changing the government there. So the position of Erdogan in Syria is not the good position. Someday they have to make some compromise on that and leave the Syrian territory.
Okay, and on that note, thank you both for being with me. Mahmoud Rafat, international relations expert out of Stockholm. Ali Safari, journalist and foreign affairs analyst out of Tehran. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
That lines, the lawyer of an Iranian national jailed in Sweden tells Press TV the court is not competent to hear Hamid Nouri's case. North Korea says it has launched a military reconnaissance satellite, but the launch failed after the rocket's second stage malfunctioned. And Russia accuses the West of supporting genocide in Ukraine by favoring a peace plan offered by Ukrainian President Zelensky. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, the lawyer of Hamid Nouri, an Iranian national jailed in Sweden for alleged rights abuses, has told Press TV about a situation. Thomas Bodström says the court lacks competence to hear the accusation leveled against his client.
I cannot understand why we should have a trial in Sweden about what happened in another country 35 years ago from a person who is not a Swedish person, what he maybe have done to other people who are not Swedes at all. So that has nothing to do with Sweden.
Bodström said Nouri's trial has not been, quote, fair and has had so many mistakes. He said some of the witnesses introduced against the defendant have had conflict of interests in the case. The lawyer said Nouri should be acquitted despite all the evidence brought up against him. Bodström said his client lost valuable documents required for defense due to what the court claims to be erasing by mistake. The lawyer slammed Swedish authorities for not allowing Nouri to visit his family members. He said Nouri is entitled by law to have in-person visitations. Bodström said his client has now spent more than 3.5 years in solitary confinement. He said the long period was a, quote, record in Sweden.
And what I am most upset about, he is almost isolated 24 hours a day. And now he has been there for more than 3.5 years. This will be his fourth summer in custody if they don't let him go out, which I hope they will. But so this is the worst part, because he is isolated for 7 square meters. And okay, we can come and visit him, but we cannot go more than once a week or once a week because we are just lawyers and we are working with the case. And he has asked for new glasses so he can read better for since we came into the case. It's almost 8-9 months. Nothing has happened. So he's treated very bad. And we complain about it all the time, but nothing happened.
Nuri was arrested upon arrival in Stockholm in November 2019. Swedish prosecutors accuse him of involvement in the execution of members of the Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist organization. The group is responsible for killing at least 17,000 Iranians. Tehran has rejected the accusations against Nuri as politically motivated. Iran's president says unilateralism is giving way to multilateralism, where the fate of the world will be determined by regional countries and organizations. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with Kairat Saribai, the visiting secretary general of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia. CICA is a multinational forum for enhancing cooperation toward promoting peace, security, and stability in Asia. Raisi stressed the need for constant contact between CICA's member states, saying the organization has great potential and its role should be strengthened. Saribai hailed Iran's active participation in the organization's events, particularly on fighting terrorism and boosting economic development. He called for Iran to share its experience in science and technology with other CICA members. We've been talking to CICA Secretary General Kairat Saribai on Iran's role in the organization. Let's take a listen.
Iran is our member state from the beginning. 30 years before, the first president of Kazakhstan announced or launched the initiative to have a structure that can take care on the confidence and cooperation in Asia. And from the very beginning, Iran is very proactive part of this process. The fact that within the last 2 years, I am coming to Iran with the visits for the third time, and that President Raisi personally took part at the SICA 6 summit last year in Astana, Kazakhstan, shows the very serious approach of Iran to the Conference on Interaction and Confidence Building Measures in Asia. SICA is an evolving process, and we have many opportunities to extend our actions to the good deeds, and Iran plays a very significant role within this process.
North Korea says an accident occurred during its satellite launch on Wednesday, causing the rocket to crash into the sea off the west coast of the peninsula. The state media KCNA said the new engine system and rocket fuel were unstable. It said the rocket's second stage malfunctioned. KCNA added that Pyongyang will verify the grave defects and conduct the second launch soon. Japan says a test fire was not a satellite launch, but a ballistic missile test. Tokyo had threatened to shoot down any projectile entering its territory. North Korea had notified Japan of its plan to launch its first military reconnaissance satellite. Pyongyang said the satellite was meant to monitor the military activities of the U.S. and its regional allies. South Korea's National Security Council condemned the North's launch as a serious provocation and a grave violation of U.N. Security Council resolutions. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has accused the West of, quote, supporting genocide in Ukraine by favoring President Volodymyr Zelensky's so-called peace plan. Lavrov made this statement at a meeting with Burundi's Foreign Minister Alberto Shingiro in Bujumbura. The Russian minister said the peace plan would, quote, destroy everything Russian in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. Lavrov also quoted Zelensky as saying that Kiev's forces would kill every Russian if they recapture the two regions. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. also accused Washington of encouraging Kiev by ignoring the drone attack on Moscow. Anatoly Antonov said U.S. officials claim that Ukraine uses drones just to gather information as an encouragement for Ukrainian terrorists. And staying with Russia, President Vladimir Putin says Ukraine's recent drone strike on Moscow was a, quote, terrorist act.
We already mentioned the possibility of carrying strikes against decision-making centers. And of course, one of them is the headquarters of Ukrainian military intelligence, which we attacked 2 or 3 days ago. In response, the Kyiv regime chose another route. They are trying to scare Russia, scaring the people of Russia, and carrying out strikes against residential buildings. This is a clear sign of terrorist activity.
Putin said the attack aimed to provoke Russia to retaliate. On Tuesday, the Russian capital was targeted by a swarm of drones For the first time since the war with Ukraine began last year, the strike targeted several areas, including a suburban neighborhood where the Russian president has an official residence. The Russian Defense Ministry said it was Kiev's biggest drone attack on Moscow. A Russian official said two people were injured as a result. A Ukrainian presidential aide denied Kiev's involvement in the strike, but said it, quote, enjoyed watching the developments. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us earlier from Moscow with the latest on the recent drone attacks on the Russian capital.
Yes, well, I went to one of these sites this morning. It took me a while to find the exact site. Moscow is a big city, and the damage really is very minor. A few broken windows, not much more than that. I spoke to some of the residents who were living in that block. They were more bemused than anything else, and irritated that they had to be evacuated from their apartments at 6 o'clock. So minor damage, no casualties. But it looks like the response from Russia may be a lot more than breaking a few windows inside Ukraine. Of course, a kind of almost a mass drone attack on Russia's capital is being treated as a very serious thing here in Russia. Interesting, Vladimir Putin's words earlier today. He said that a few days ago, Russia hit the military intelligence headquarters in Kiev. It's very difficult to know how successful Russia's strikes are in Kiev, because there's a media blackout. Ukrainian citizens aren't allowed to film the damage. Ukraine puts out propaganda saying they always shoot down all these missiles.
Divisions grow in the EU over the bloc's relentless military support for Ukraine. EU member Hungary favors peace negotiations, and that stance is creating tensions, as our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes now reports.
EU leaders accused the Hungarian government of casting democratic values aside with respect to judicial reforms and press freedom. However, analysts say their real issue is that Budapest is not towing the line with respect to the war in Ukraine. EU affairs ministers met on Tuesday to debate so-called EU values in Hungary. On her way into the meeting, Hungarian Justice Minister Judith Varga slated the European Parliament for criticising her government. Minister Varga says that the European Parliament does not respect EU values, does not respect democracy in Hungary, does not respect rule of law. What do you think?
The European Parliament has full democratic legitimacy to adopt the resolutions in case they see the political need to do so. So that's the only comment I have.
The EU has so far spent 10 billion euro on weapons for Ukraine. EU nation Hungary is against the policy, and that seriously irks Brussels and Washington.
There is no chance to win this war. So therefore, what we should do far more energy invest into to convince everybody that the only solution is ceasefire.
Experts say Prime Minister Orban is correct to suggest the EU is concentrating too much on propelling the Ukraine war.
He definitely has a point, because here in Brussels you hear people saying, okay, it's always about Ukraine, it's Ukraine this, Ukraine that. But we should not forget the Palestinians in Gaza. We should not forget the Syrians. We should not forget the Sudanese.
It's clear the Hungarian government is a major thorn in the side of the EU project at present. However, Eurosceptic parties in other member states are on course to make significant gains in forthcoming elections, helped on by the cost of living crisis. Therefore, the problems might only be starting for the establishment here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The UK has the highest food inflation rate in the industrialized world, according to researchers at the London School of Economics. Extra barriers on food imports from the European Union since the UK left the bloc has been an important factor. Site put us a report from London.
It's no secret now that you don't get much for a pound in Britain these days, and households are the ones feeling the pain.
The food price, they went really up and up. You can buy lots of stuff now. You need to reduce.
It is absolutely increase in high level. They increase a lot. Every day you will go to supermarket, 10-20p every single day almost.
At more than 19%, food inflation here remains at the highest levels in over four decades, meaning an even greater squeeze on the budgets of low-income families. One of the drivers of inflation, new research shows, Brexit.
What is clear, and I would agree with that, is that Brexit has lowered people's living standards. All right? We voted for this nonsense, and now people are beginning to regret it. But it's a little bit too late.
The government admits the costs are getting out of control and is working with food producers, farmers, and supermarkets to explore ways to reduce the pressure on households and to find out if middle companies are taking out too much profit. Trade unions say higher costs are not trickling down to the workers. While there have been strikes and higher pay settlements with some sectors, the gap between people's pay and price increases is substantial.
What's happened, of course, is this year people have taken wage rises that are below inflation. That means that their living standards are falling. So next year, guess what? They're going to try to catch up. And that's why it's going to be more persistent than a lot of central banks thought and a lot of people in the markets thought.
The UK's central bank has increased interest rates 12 times now to try and tame inflation, but the rate is still higher here than in all G7 nations. And that has meant more people falling on hard times. Today, 1 in 7 Britons is skipping meals due to the rising cost of living.
So many people not being able to afford food or having to skip meals is a sobering thought in a wealthy economy like the UK's. But that is the reality of the inflation crisis and of post-Brexit Britain. Syed Pariza, London.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has called a snap election for July 23rd. However, that's a very risky decision as his left-wing coalition government suffered heavy losses in regional ballots.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez on Monday said he would dissolve Parliament and call for a snap election for July 23rd, a day after conservatives and the far right posted strong gains in regional and municipal polls.
I had a meeting with His Majesty the King and have informed the head of state of my intention to hold a cabinet meeting this afternoon to dissolve Parliament and call a general election according to the prerogative bestowed on the Prime Minister by the Constitution. The official announcement of the election will appear in the official bulletin tomorrow, and the election will take place on Sunday, July 23rd, according to the time frame established by law. I've made this decision based on the election results yesterday.
Spain was due to hold general elections by the end of the year, but the socialist leader announced his decision to move up the date following Sunday's local polls, which saw his party suffer heavy losses across the country, which concluded with nearly all of the country's largest cities in the hands of the center-right Popular Party, including longtime socialist stronghold Seville. Sanchez said these results suggest Spaniards should clarify which political forces they want to take the lead, adding that it was time to let the people take the floor and define the country's political direction. Meanwhile, the leader of Spain's conservative opposition, People's Party, welcomed the announcement of a snap general election in July and asked voters to give his party a clear majority.
Spain yesterday took the first step to open a new political cycle, and from this very moment, I call to all the citizens to finish off that political cycle on July 23. To call snap elections doesn't hide what happened yesterday. Spaniards have said, enough, we've had it up to here. I thank and value this feeling was translated into a clear victory of the People's Party.
Only 3 of the 12 regions that held elections retained socialist dominance by very narrow margins, while the remaining 9 were won by the People's Party. However, the Conservatives will require coalitions or informal support agreements with the far-right Vox Party in 6 regions where the People's Party fell short of securing a working majority.
Brazilian President Lula da Silva has called on South American countries to unite for regional development. Lula made the remarks at a summit of 12 South American countries in Brasilia that also included Venezuela. The Brazilian president urged state banks to work together to finance development. He said the region should reduce dependence on extra-regional currencies for trade. Without mentioning the U.S. dollar, he also proposed creating a regional energy market. Lula said South American integration was interrupted in recent years by conservative governments like his far-right predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. Intense clashes have resumed in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, despite an agreement between the warring factions to extend the ceasefire, which was mediated by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. The new clashes came after Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces agreed to extend the truce for 5 more days. The ceasefire was first announced on May 20th. It expired on Monday. Residents reported fighting in all 3 adjoining cities, which make up the greater Khartoum. Both sides accuse each other of violating the truce. The mediators say the ceasefire has allowed the delivery of humanitarian aid despite repeated violations. Violence broke out in the country in mid-April over the proposed integration of the RSF into the regular army. Over 700 people have been killed in the conflict, and 1.4 million have fled to neighboring countries. That's a wrap for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting. And everlasting praise
that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Imam Reza lively debates. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest felicitations to you on a very auspicious day. Today, the 11th of the sacred month of Dhul-Qa'dah, is the birth anniversary of a very blessed person whose shrine in the northeastern city of Mashhad makes it the holiest spot in Iran. Mashhad, the capital of Khorasan province, has for the past few days become the cynosure of the eyes of the faithful, whether in Iran or anywhere around the world. Pilgrims are pouring in from various places, and according to estimates, those assembled this city at the sprawling golden-domed mausoleum number around 2 million. There are some who have traveled on foot from different provinces of Iran. The city wears a festive look. It has been bedecked with flowers and colorful fluorescent lights in honor of the person who reposes in eternal peace. He is none other than Imam Reza, peace upon him, the 8th infallible heir of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. For your information, his birth anniversary marks the culmination of Dahiye Keramat, or the 10 days of munificence, which the Islamic Republic of Iran celebrates every year from the 1st of Dhul-Qa'dah, the day, the 80 Imam's virtuous sister, Hazrat Fatima Masume, whose shrine is in Qom, was born several years after the birthday of her brother. Before we present you a special feature on this blessed occasion, here are some words of wisdom from Imam Reza, peace upon him, to ponder upon in order to enlighten our hearts and minds. Hypocrites are characterized by three features: telling lies, reneging on promises, and breaching of trust. This apt description of many of the supposedly prominent people of our own times are not the words of any starry-eyed philosopher, nor sure of what he says, nor of a scholar who does not practice what he preaches, and neither of any political thinker constantly changing his views as per the direction in which the wind blows. These are the words of a person whom God Almighty granted eternity to such an extent that till this day, even after the passing of over a millennium and 2.5 centuries since his physical departure from the world, he continues to rule the hearts and minds of the believers. Imam Reza, peace upon him, needs no introduction to anyone familiar with Islam, the school of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, and Iran's history, culture, and contemporary events. Born in Holy Medina in 148 AH, corresponding to 766 AD, 2 weeks after the martyrdom of his grandfather, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, to Imam Musa Kazim and his pious wife, Hazrat Najme, peace upon them, he was destined to find his final resting place at the age of 55 in distant Khorasan, northeastern Iran, where he was forced to come from Hejaz by the self-styled caliph Ma'mun of the usurper Abbasid regime. Afraid of the popularity of the imam among the Muslim ummah, and in order to deceive the people, the crafty Ma'mun deceitfully declared the prophet's venerable descendant as his heir apparent, although Imam Reza, peace upon him, was some 20 years older than him in age. He showed outward respect to the imam, and when his plots to mislead the people failed, he had the guest secretly poisoned to death and then joined the funeral in black clothes, pretending that he was innocent of murder. Ma'mun was thus a hypocrite who used to lie glibly, renege on his own promises, and breach the trust. Let us focus on one of the debates of Imam Reza, peace upon him, who, as repository of divine knowledge, spared no efforts during his 20-year imamat to enlighten Muslims and all those who came into contact with him, including Jews, Christians, Sabians, Zoroastrians, Hindus, and atheists. Following the martyrdom of his father, Imam Kazim, peace upon him, in 183 AH in Baghdad, in the prison of the Abbasid tyrant Harun, he traveled to the port city of Basra in Iraq in order to disprove the claims of those who deviated from the truth. Imam Reza, peace upon him, stayed in the house of a Hashemite kinsman named Hassan ibn Muhammad al-Alawi and held a session for a group of Muslims, amongst whom was Amr ibn Haddab, who had deviated from the path of the Ahlul Bayt. In this session of a lively debate, a Jewish rabbi and a Christian priest were also present. The Imam told them that they have been invited so that they can ask him about Islam, the Prophet's Sunnah, and the legacy of the God-given authority of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Amr ibn Haddab said to him, "I am told that you know all that which God has sent down, including the various languages the people speak." Imam Reza, peace upon him, replied in the affirmative, which made Amr say, "First of all, I want to test you through languages. This is a Roman, this is an Indian, this is an Iranian, and this is a Turk. We have brought them before you." The Imam said that, by the will of God, he would answer them in their own languages if they raise any question. To the utter astonishment of Amr, the Jewish rabbi, the Christian priest, and the people of other ethnicities who were present, Imam Reza, peace upon him, fluently spoke with each of them in their native languages, that is, Latin, Sanskrit, Persian, and Turkish. After answering the questions of the non-Arabs, Imam Reza, peace upon him, turned to Amr ibn Haddab and said in flawless Arabic that he will be tried in these days on charges of murdering one of his blood relations. At this, Amr expressed doubt, saying that none except God has knowledge of the unseen. The Imam drew his attention to what God has said in the Noble Quran, that He, the Almighty, who is the knower of the unseen, does not reveal His secrets to any except to Him whom He chooses as the Prophet. The Imam added, "We are the inheritors of God's last and greatest messenger, who informed us of what was and what will be till the day of resurrection." It is said that as per the prediction of Imam Reza, peace upon him, 5 days later, Amr ibn Haddab suffered the fate of which he was foretold, and confessed that he had been concealing his crime of murder of which no one else was informed. Imam Reza, peace upon him, then held lively discussions with the Christian priest and the Jewish rabbi, quoting from the various Gospels of the Bible, the Torah, and other sacred texts of Judaism, including the Psalms of David. To the amazement of the Christian and the Jew, the Imam proved to them the real meaning of so many passages in the Old and New Testaments, pointing out that these pertain to the mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The two argued with the Imam for some days, but couldn't prove that Jesus or Ezra had ever claimed to be sons of God, as alleged by the Christians and Jews, respectively. On the contrary, Imam Reza, peace upon him, proved to them that Moses, Jesus, and other prophets had given the Israelites the tidings of the advent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. To their utter surprise, by quoting passages from their religious scriptures, Imam Reza, peace upon him, pointed out that these are direct references to not just the Prophet of Islam, but to his divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, and to the latter sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, as well as to Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon them all. During the Imam's stay in Basra, the Christian priest embraced the truth of Islam and decided to travel to Medina to become more familiar with Islamic teachings, especially the classes that the eighth Imam used to hold in the holy city. The Jewish rabbi, after debating with Imam Reza, peace upon him, was full of admiration for his deep knowledge, eloquence, and rational interpretation of what was mentioned about the last prophet and his blessed household, the Ahlul Bayt, in the scriptures revealed by God to Moses and other prophets. Several years later, when Imam Reza, peace upon him, came to Khorasan, Ma'mun also tried to test the knowledge of the Prophet's righteous successor by assembling in the city of Marv scholars of the Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, Sabians, Hindus, and atheists. Needless to say, the Imam not only triumphed in these debates, but convinced most of them to become Muslim. These and other developments unnerved Ma'mun, and he decided to return to Baghdad by taking the Imam with him. But while halting at Tus, he deceitfully made the Imam eat poisoned grapes. The result was the martyrdom of Imam Reza, peace upon him, and his being laid to rest in Khorasan. Here we present you an excellent description of the human heart and its functions by the eighth Imam, peace upon him. As for the heart, it is one of Allah's marvelous signs in the human body, since it pumps the blood to all parts of the body, and the blood conveys food and oxygen in order to distribute them throughout the body, and then it arranges for the discharge of waste products from the body of them. The heart pumps the blood to the lungs so that they may take adequate supply of oxygen from the air which a person breathes. In the lungs, the blood gets rid of some waste products which it gathers from the parts of the blood and which take form of a gas called carbon dioxide. The heart also pumps the blood to the kidneys. As for the regulation of the beats of the heart, it is one of the secrets of creation. The average of the beats of the heart is 70 times per minute, which amounts to 100,000 times a day, 40 million times a year, and over 2,000 million in middle age. Therefore, we must think of this great glorification which never ceases nor flags by night and day.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio.
visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Air pollution. Part 1.
We've seen videos and images on the internet with this writing on them. This spot on Earth is a real haven. Lush green forests, beaches with white sands, the water in the sea that's so pure it looks like glass, and a unique wildlife. I mean, somewhere like Borneo in Southeast Asia, an island that's divided between three countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the tiny state of Brunei. The Borneo forests are a live nature museum. It's one of the oldest rainforests on the planet. That's the habitat of over 15 flora species, 420 bird species, and 222 mammals. You cannot see these living beings anywhere else in the world. All of these have turned Borneo into a real heaven. But the heaven is not far away from hell. From 1985 to 2005, every year, 850 hectares of Borneo forests have been ruined. Only from August to October 2019, over 8,578 square kilometers of forests in Borneo were destroyed in a rare fire incident. The fire and the smoke bellowing in the air was so widespread that the pollution reached 1,100 kilometers away to Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, as well as Kuala Lumpur and Singapore, and darkened the sky.
For 3 months, locals lived under a blanket of toxic sulfurous smog.
In 3 months, over 600 million tons of carbon dioxide was emitted to the atmosphere. It was more than the carbon dioxide Australia produces in a year. It was 13 times more than the CO2 emitted from the automobiles all over the world in a year. The incident got environmental activists worried, but in Indonesia, almost no one cared.
Nearly 10 million children are at risk from air pollution from Indonesia's forest fires. That's according to the United Nations. UNICEF is warning the children could suffer lifelong physical and cognitive damage.
Right at a time when people in Southeast Asia were choking to death and the animals were perishing in droves, Indonesian President Joko Widodo issued a new decree that gave people the thumbs up to ruin even more forests and establish palm farms instead of the old trees.
Palm oil, a multi-billion dollar industry with a pretty bad reputation. It's been blamed, among other things, for wiping out rainforests, pushing animals such as the orangutan towards extinction.
The farms were the main factor for the survival of the 255 strong population of Indonesia, and of course, the main factor for their death.
I only own 1 hectare of land, on which I harvest about 400 to 500 kilograms of palm oil. I need about €7 a day to feed my family and for my children to go to school. If the quality of the fruit is poor, I barely make €6, which isn't enough. I'm constantly in debt. I don't own anything anymore. Even a kiosk owner has loaned me money. I own everybody money, and I can't afford cigarettes. We can only buy what we absolutely need to live.
When you go to a whopping mall for your daily shopping, when you're sitting in a restaurant to eat dinner, when you wash your hair with shampoo in the bathroom, when you're biting off a piece of chocolate, when you're using cosmetics, and in many other things you do during the day, you're in fact using palm oil. Almost 80 kilograms for each person annually. Now, if we know that 85% of the palm oil in the world comes from Indonesia and Malaysia, we can ask a few important questions. Who's burning the forests? Who's polluting the air? Are the poor farmers in Borneo behind the increased levels of CO2 in the air? Or is it the people who buy and use palm oil every day more than before? During the past 20 years, Malaysia's palm oil exports have increased 1,500 times, and the turnover now stands at over $21 billion. The country is a top producer of palm oil in the world. The world's never-ending demand for palm oil has made the people in Indonesia to break the boundaries. Instead of planting rice and vegetables, despite the hardships and enjoying the beauties of the nature in the country, they've opted for industrial farming of palm trees with a shorter life, but with more amenities. We're talking about $400 of monthly income for a 2-hectare farm with about 400 palm trees. The income isn't considered meager in Southeast Asia. It can tempt anyone.
In many other regions, too, rainforest is being burnt down. 2.6 million hectares have been destroyed, a region almost the size of Belgium. Palm oil companies are responsible for about half the fires laid. Who did this?
They can't find the arsonists, or don't want to find them. But everything here was burnt down, even our fields and houses.
Why not sell your land?
It's the most precious thing I own. If we work with the palm oil company, we have to take on debt. I have 4 sons. I want them to have the land, and I'll defend it.
The deliberate destruction of the forests in Borneo has taken a huge toll on the environment, but maybe the most important of all was the destruction of the orangutan's habitat. During the past 4 decades, the population of orangutans in this region has been reduced to half. The animal is on the list of the endangered species now. Hence, in 2009, a group of environmental activists put on orangutan uniforms and held a protest rally outside the headquarters of one of the largest oil palm consumers in the world, namely Nestle. It might seem to be an odd comparison, but these days, if you bite off a piece of yummy chocolate and you're carefree, you're in fact an accomplice in killing an orangutan. According to the protesters, large industrial firms that don't care about the damage are to blame for the environmental pollution caused by palm oil. The only thing they care about is an increase in their income. Every year, 8 million people in the world die due to smoking. Annually, about 770,000 people in the world die from AIDS. And annually, over 435,000 people lose their lives for being infected with malaria. Large media in the world are quick to spread the news and put the fatalities of those causes in the limelight. When someone dies in a car accident, it's something you can see with your own eyes. But there aren't many people who are aware of the annual death toll of 9 million people in the world due to air pollution. That is 1 out of every 9 deaths in the world due to air pollution. As a death is invisible, it's hard to trace. The death rate due to air pollution is larger than fatalities from AIDS, diabetes, and car accidents combined. 95% of people all over the world breathe polluted air every day. Things are far worse in developing countries. Children's lifespan in Southeast Asia is 30 months, and in the southeast of the Sahara Desert, 24 months less. In Europe, polluted air takes the lives of people 15 times more than road accidents. It has reduced life expectancy in Britain by 1.5 years. Perhaps the invisible crisis served as an incentive for U.S. journalist Beth Gardner to publish a damning book on this subject. Gardner lives in London along with her British husband and young daughter. She's carried out extensive research on air pollution. She's traveled to different parts of the world to find out the source of air pollution and why people lose their lives to it. The outcome of her trips and research is her book Choked, which highlights shocking facts.
I've lived in London for more than 18 years. I came here from New York. But as much as I've always loved Britain, there was something that bothered me from the start, a thickness to the air, the smell of exhaust that hit me every time I walked outside. It was only years later, when I was working on an article about air quality at the 2012 Olympics, that I sat down to read some of the science of what air pollution does to our bodies and how much of it there is here in London. It only took a few minutes of Googling for me to see that the fumes I dismissed as a nuisance were actually toxic.
In one of the points, she's mentioned the controversial decision by the European Union to use cars run on diesel fuels in the 90s. The decision was made based on the argument it would reduce CO2 emission and was a plus for the environment. But what happened was actually the polar opposite. Millions of people were exposed to higher degrees of nitrogen dioxide, which is way more dangerous than carbon dioxide. Such decisions are not unprecedented throughout history. In 1921, American chemist Thomas Midgley concluded that if he added lead to gasoline, he could prevent knocking in internal combustion engines. So, until the 70s, lead was used as an additive to gasoline almost all over the world. But suddenly it was revealed lead was very harmful for our health. It wasn't the first disaster left by Midgley. He was a person who discovered chlorofluorocarbons combinations for the first time, and in 1941, the American Chemical Society gave Midgley its highest award, the Priestley Medal. Later on, it was revealed that CFCs have ozone-depleting effects, and Midgley was named the most harmful scientist in history. In another part, Gardner mentions the Volkswagen scandal known as Dieselgate. In 2008, North American and European countries decided to use a solution called AdBlue to reduce air pollution. AdBlue is made up of 32.5% pure urea and 62.5% deionized water and is widely used in Euro 5 and Euro 6 automobiles. The solution is added to the catalyst section of diesel-run cars and reduces the poisonous gases of nitrogen oxides to a large extent. It is used in many engines in large volumes, including in Audis, Mercedes, and BMW products. But in 2008, Volkswagen announced that the company's 2000cc engines do not need AdBlue. After a while, Americans found out they had been badly deceived. Volkswagen had used some software with complicated algorithm to bypass the emission standard tests to show lower amounts of pollution. Volkswagen CEO Martin Winterkorn resigned after the scandal, and 500,000 cars produced by Volkswagen were recalled from across the world. Furthermore, Volkswagen had to pay up to $22 million as a fine, but the fine went to the pockets of the governments. Actually, it didn't make up for the disaster it had wreaked on the environment and human beings. According to U.S. officials, the cars caused pollution over 40 times more than normal cars.
Waging war on pollution, this is a younger generation's fight back following the recent revelations that the air we breathe is dirty and dangerous.
So we wanted to make it quite anarchic, a little bit dangerous, revolution, sort of that kind of attitude.
Vasilisa's group Clean Air Now started this anti-pollution billboard campaign to try and engage a younger audience.
We'd really like to see more people become aware of the problems of air pollution and in that way start to reach out to the government and then for them to take more action.
Whilst air pollution might bring to mind Beijing or Delhi, in Europe, France, Germany, Spain, Italy and Britain have all been found to be breaching air pollution limits.
Well, using this monitor, you can see the level of dust particles in the air, and it's changing all the time and actually often spiking to get to a level that over a sustained period would be considered unsafe. Now, areas like this have proven so bad for the air quality that the EU has issued the UK with a final warning and told Britain to clean up or face the consequences.
There have been numerous similar scandals in recent years. Gardner has highlighted one of them that has to do with Boris Johnson, former UK Prime Minister and London Mayor. According to the research, when Johnson was the Mayor of London, he had gotten dust particle suppressants sprayed around air quality monitors to bring down their readings. These deceptive methods are for advanced countries. In